T.S. Eliot wrote, "What we call the beginning is often the end. And to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. And only those who risk going too far can possibly find out how far they can go." I have been fascinated recently by time. I've been fascinated by physics, by this intersection of religion and physics, about how just how weird and wonderful existence is. I love physics. I find that out now. In high school, I didn't know that. In high school, I pretty much knew that the end and the beginning of my physics, this is for people of a certain age, was with Julius Sumner Miller. And if you put math into it, being enumerate, I completely blanked out. I had no idea and no appreciation. And now I read everything that I can, whether I understand it or not. I see everything Nova has to offer because just the wild improbability, or, as somebody was saying before the service, the inevitability of our situation is just fascinating to me. I love this great intersection. Time. Well, maybe as we get older, we appreciate time more because we understand the theory of relativity. It speeds up as we get older. The exception being certain sermons, but I'll talk about that later. I was explained the theory of relativity when I was 8 years old. We had in my father's and community property state and mother's store a stock clerk who went to Caltech. And I, of course, had heard of Einstein and the theory of relativity, and I asked him to explain it to me. And he said, "I can explain it to you, but you won't understand it for 5 years. And I said, "Okay, explain it to me." He said, "Well, time is just relative. But you're 8 years old, but in 5 years you'll get it. If you sit on a hot stove for a second, it's an hour. If a pretty girl sits on your lap for an hour, it's a second." And this person was completely correct. I didn't understand it for, all right, 6 years. The whole idea of time is so fascinating, of beginnings, because if you're going to have beginnings and middles and ends, you have to have a sense of time. All the way back to the first century of the Common Era, Hellenistic Greeks and Jews understood a very sophisticated sense of time. The question God asked, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth." Well, what happened before the beginning? How long did God sit there going, "I wonder what I'm going to do today. I got 5,000 stations on cable and nothing to watch. Maybe I should create something." And philosophers ask, how long did God contemplate this? To which the real philosopher said, "That's a stupid question. It's a stupid question intellectually, because if there is nothing, there is no movement, there is no matter, there is no change, ergo, there's no time. Time begins at creation." That's an extraordinarily sophisticated idea, and that's over 2,000 years ago. So in case we're feeling too smart right now, this should give us pause to understand that we are the same intellectual creatures that our forebearers were. No, they didn't have either the advantage or disadvantage of, like God, of cable TV or of the Internet. They had their minds to contemplate this rich area of wondering about their own journeys and what it meant. Space has changed also over the years, our concept of space. Once upon a time, when you read old manuscripts, you find out that space was filled with this stuff called ether, sometimes spelled E-T-H-E-R, sometimes spelled A-E-T-H-E-R, that was not nothing, but not something in the way we think of it, but some way of interconnecting all matter. That idea was thrown away for a couple of centuries, and people decided that space, that area between ourselves and the other planets, was a perfect vacuum filled with nothing. And then Einstein came along and said, you know, it can't really be nothing, because we understand that sound can't go through nothing. That's okay, so it's kind of nothing. But we also understand that light, in order to be transmitted, needs to have a medium of transmission. And that began his binding of space as something that is not nothing. His binding of that space with time. And so now, for the moment, we have time and space together as a concept that's always imperfectly understood, because our ideas, our images, are always changing. And that's difficult. Change is difficult, but it's also a lot of fun, because our lives are not involved in just memorizing either religious or scientific catechism, but in being actively involved in searching really for metaphors, for ways of trying to picture what it is that we live in, the time and the space that we swim through, the beginnings and the middles and the ends of our journeys. Life has always been fascinating to religious, to philosophers, and to scientists. The questions of primatology, not primatology, that's primates, but where we come from, our origins, of eschatology, of the final things, where we're going, and what do we do here in these precious moments that we have to share with each other, to be with each other, to be friends or enemies, to be comrades in arms, to find ways of celebrating life and our lives and our possibilities. How shall we be here? Where do the rules come from? Where do we come from? Where are we going? Space, time, science, religion, everyone right now is involved one way or another in this conflict, apparent conflict between science and religion. We act as if they are two completely diametrically opposed systems, as opposed to being systems of metaphors. When I look at religion, whether present religion, we had long discussions over this last week with our family and friends in Mexico about just what is a religion and what is a cult. Easy answer. Cult is new. Cult plus time is religion. You're dealing with metaphors. And people will say, look, the metaphor of Zeus and Hera and Jupiter, those are all, or Yahweh, are all crazy metaphors. But my belief in molecules and atoms and quarks and neutrons and neutrinos, my belief that the Large Hadron Collider can find the God particle. Do you know the origin of the God particle? That's not what it was called in the beginning. Can I say this in a Unitarian church? It was called the goddamn particle. And because it was eluding them and they were frustrating and said, where does mass come from? And they weren't talking about Catholic mass. That's a historic question. They're talking about where does mass attach itself to being? Where does that ether get stuffness? And it's that goddamn particle. And they decided, you know, that's a bad marketing decision. So we're just going to cut the dam off of it, and it's the God particle. I'm not making this up. That's the true story of how the God particle got its name. And we're still looking, again, metaphorically for understanding existence as quivering strings of matter and of energy and searching those particles and those waves to figure out just what we are and what it all means and where it comes from and where we're going, and most importantly, what to do with this precious miracle now. How to look at that day out there and say, wow, it is a gorgeous day filled with possibilities. How to look at that world out there and say, there is pain and there is suffering and we are called to engage it. And there is also such great beauty. We want to look at religion and science in opposition, but they're no more opposed necessarily than a symphony or poetry is opposed to mathematics. They're different ways of perceiving and appreciating and handling and creating the metaphors for existence. Music, we know, is experiential. But we also know, if you listen to Bach, if you've listened to the Goldberg variations, we know that there is a mathematical structure. They don't take away from each other. They're different experiences. We have poetry and we have equations. They are ways of being in the world, and we as human beings experience both understanding and wonder, and those are not in opposition. We look at the great questions, the philosophical and physical questions that Heisenberg posed about knowing where you are and where you're going, and that you can't know both, which is a little disconcerting. And I'm of course interested in knowing both, but Heisenberg assures me that I can't. But I'm a bicycler. And one of the things about biking, and roller skaters and ice skaters know this also, you will go where you're looking. There is an automatic predisposition to go where your eyes are. My wife and I were bicycling up in Canada once, and we normally ride a tandem. And I'm in front, because I make all of the decisions in our family when we're on the bicycle. At all other times, she makes the decisions. And I had gone around this lake, and I'd come back and I'd said to her, it's so gorgeous, you got to get a bike and go. And so she rented a bike also, and we went on this ride. And in about 300 yards, she crashed into a snowbank. I asked her, what happened? She said, I'm so used to being on the back where I'm just looking around, and I was still looking around and just went where my eyes took me. Well, okay, we have to look forward, and we have to look around, and we have to be attentive, but, you know, being locked in one position with your eyes just forward is automatic pilot, and it doesn't necessarily take you where you want to go. One of the things about biking, and maybe one of the things about life and about time, is that we have to look back to know where we've and look back where we have been to know where we are, look forward to where we are going, and pay attention to where we are now. To pay attention with a sense of caution of all the traffic and a sense of wonder of all the beauty, a sense of responsibility because there are others on the road. And all of those things come together. When we have vision, when we look forward, it's an act of choice, not something automatic. And it involves a responsibility. When I'm biking and I look in a direction, I've got to evaluate what's out there, what's behind me, what's in front of me, what's next to me. And where I look and where I focus my attention expresses choice, responsibility, and intent on my part. Vision and envisioning a future is not something that is just a silly exercise. It is an exercise in responsibility and intentionality. Most of us, as thinking, caring beings, want to move ahead, want to move forward, but the direction is not obvious. The past doesn't compel us to a particular future, but it predisposes us towards a particular future. Our religious traditions give us lots of opportunities to look back, to look inside, in order to move forward. We have our bell that sends us into a place of meditation here. However brief it is, I assure you, it is 10 times longer than in the first congregation where when we attempted 40 years ago, bless you, and when I say it, it counts. 40 years ago, when we tried a meditation, the discomfort was palpable and audible. Now we have gotten a little better at being quiet, at going inside. Our religious traditions offer... You too. Okay, bless you too. Only one more per service. We're Unitarians. If it's on three, you know, we become Trinitarians. Our religious traditions offer us opportunities to go inside. In the Jewish tradition, the 10 days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are times you're supposed to evaluate and fix and repair, not just feel guilty, but fix stuff. In the Shiite sect of Islam, Ashura, also 10 days, are 10 days of repentance, of getting straight, of putting your lives together. In Christianity, the 40 days of Lent are opportunities to look inside. Are whether religious or secular, if you have a, I told you I'd get back to this, if you have a particularly boring sermon, use it. Use it as a chance to go into an alpha state. You all did it in junior high school. All of you went into an alpha state, whether you were science or algebra or history are different. I mean, we all kind of went there. It's okay. It's a place where we do some of that spiritual business. We all have every religious tradition, mantras and mandalas and chants and liturgies and litanies and ways of finding out where we are in time and space, in thinking about where we want to go in time and space. Because if we don't examine our lives, we'll be on automatic pilot. We may have started off well, but it's important to stop and change and recalibrate from time to time all the various aspects of our lives, to have our politics and our religion, not simply what we inherited, and it doesn't mean throwing them away, but examining them with an ability to move forward with something that is truly our own and the result of an examined life and examined values. Those are the opportunities of time as we live together in time and space. We are all dealt various cards, to change the metaphor, and we can't change the cards that we are dealt, but what we hold, what we draw, how we play, the ethical standards to which we adhere by choice are an important part of examining our past, our lives, and being a part, not wholly, but a part of determining our future. Where we are and where we have been and what we choose today helps us create a tomorrow which most of us want to reflect our deepest examined values. There's no assurance that we get what we want. There's every chance that from time to time in every life, we will end up in this great sea of being on shoals of failure. But then what? Then we recalibrate. we recommit, we re-examine, and we begin anew with whatever part we have left, whichever part of the burrito you have, the half-eaten or the remaining burrito, this time that we have together, when we examine it, when we share it, when we learn from each other, and part of learning is also correcting each other and helping each other and inspiring each other. There are many, particularly for new people here, there are many people who come here not for answers, because at these prices you don't get answers, but what you get is the opportunity of sharing and learning from people of many traditions and many ways, of being together, of worshiping together, of committing ourselves to a better future for a wider and wider circle of humanity. Religion is being bound up together in an enterprise of great importance. It isn't manifest in our catechisms. It isn't manifest in our confessions. It's manifest in what we do, in how we embrace each other, how we embrace our differences, how we embrace the future. This is a place where many different religions come together as a vase, really, as a flower pot, where we put our different ideas, our different backgrounds, our different traditions, and celebrate that bouquet that we have. We understand that bouquets live in time, and that time is relatively brief, and that's why we appreciate real flowers so much more. Their finitude, their brevity, helps us appreciate this time, this today, this moment that we share with each other, this time of choice and this time of life.